Aloha, Rick Sengaria, Vermont Edition. This podcast has been edited for brevity. So enjoy. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. By 2030, it's projected that Vermont will become the oldest state in the country with more than 25% of the state's population over 65. All this week, VPR has looked at the impact that this demographic shift will have on the state's economy and its affordable housing shortage. The change is also expected to impact the healthcare system because studies show that older individuals use much more healthcare services than young people. But there is some very promising news in this area. Don George is the president of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Vermont. He says their research shows that people over 65 who do not have a chronic condition have healthcare expenses on a par with people who are only in their 30s.
What we have found is that among the Blue Cross Blue Shield population that is aging well without having contracted a chronic condition, irrespective of their age, their consumption of healthcare services in dollar terms is just about equal. You know, if we dispel these myths, they will be very motivating for us to move forward with this, that as we age, we don't necessarily need to consume more healthcare services.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at the challenges facing the baby boom generation and how this generation may be redefining what it means to grow older in Vermont. Our guests are Monica Hutt, who is the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living. And also with us, Dr. Michael Lamantia, who is the head of geriatric medicine at the UVM Larner College of Medicine. He's also a professor at the college. Great to have you both here today. Thanks very much for being part of this program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Commissioner, you've talked about the need to develop a new paradigm to consider human development and aging and the opportunities for a healthier aging process. What do you mean by this? What's needed?
It's a great question. When I think about a new paradigm, what I'm really thinking about and talking about with people is defining for ourselves what aging means, and not necessarily just accepting the standard, the social narrative that has been a part of our world and our consciousness for so long. Aging doesn't necessarily mean weakness. It doesn't necessarily mean vulnerability. It doesn't necessarily mean frailty. What it means is your body, your mind, your spirit is growing older, and that can be strength, that can be power, that can be information, wisdom, opportunity. So I think shifting that paradigm and recognizing that the control that we have over how we age, physically, mentally, emotionally, is also something that we need to take charge of. That's the paradigm that I'm thinking about and talking about.
So is that something that needs to happen, that society needs to make that change, but the individuals as they grow older need to make that change as well?
I think that's exactly right. I think that this is a societal conversation, and I think it's an internal individual conversation. It's a family conversation. Is what do you want? What kind of a community do we collectively want to build? Because aging is the one thing that unites us. It's absolutely common. We are all getting older every single day. And I think the conversation about what we want and what we want to see for ourselves and for each other is both societal and very, very individual.
I'm so glad to hear you touch on so many important points there, Monica. You know, I think that you've made a very important point about casting aging in a positive light. We need to change that perception that we all have in our minds. I think one of the most important messages that I tell my patients is that you're not allowed to consider yourself old until you hit 95. And even then, I've had one of my patients turn 96, and she said to me, "I'm not getting any older. I'm going to count backwards." And that year, she told me she was 94. which I just love that. I think it's part of what we tell our younger members of our society about aging also. I was really proud the other night when I was driving home with my daughter in the car, and we heard something where somebody commented about being old, and they were not that old. They were maybe in their 60s. And my daughter piped up from the back seat. Now, she's 10 years old. She piped up from the back seat and said, "You're not allowed to call yourself old until you hit 95. I was glad that she was internalizing that message, because that's something that we really need to get out there for people of all ages.
Right.
And Dr. Lamantia, those statistics from Blue Cross are really quite amazing, that 80% of all people over 55 in Vermont have a chronic condition like heart disease, diabetes, or hypertension. They use twice as much health care services as someone in their 30s, and yet for 20% of the people in this age group who do not have a chronic condition, their health care usage is about the same as someone in their 30s. So, first of all, why do so many people over 55 have at least one, and in many cases, several chronic conditions?
Well, I think that when we take a look at this, this, first off, is not a new finding, that people, as they get older, they accumulate conditions. But really, as a geriatrician, someone who takes care of those persons who are above age 60 or above age 65, I really take a life course perspective. What's going on to persons when they hit age 65, age 70, age 75, it's really a consequence of what's gone on earlier in their life. So if you don't have access to good health care when you're younger, if you don't have access to economic opportunity, which we know goes along with access to health care when you're younger, then you're going to be much more likely to have accumulated these chronic conditions by the time you hit age 65 or age 70. So we really need to look at access to health care as one of the fundamental issues for our society to grapple with as we think of how we're going to age here in America.
Let's talk to Betsy, who is calling from Bristol. Hi, Betsy. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. I am a 72-year-old, so I'm in that age group that should need medication. But I have always been very, very oversensitive, and so I don't tolerate medicine. So I've had to figure out how not to get chronic conditions. I've always had sugar handling difficulties, so I just don't eat anything that is sweetened with anything. I find that I can get arthritis overnight if I eat anything that is acidic, like citric acid, vinegar, also fermented products, like soy sauce or anything like that. But if I don't eat those things, I don't have any arthritis. So I'm still able to do some construction work and clean the gutters and stuff like that, which is, a lot of 72-year-old women can't do that.
Betsy, it sounds like you're taking very good care of yourself.
Also, about 30 years ago, I stopped using toothpaste and just brushed my teeth with water and stopped getting cavities. I had found that actually toothpaste has a lot of sugar in it. And anyway, it's been interesting to see that I could overnight have chronic conditions if I didn't eat the way I do.
Betsy, thank you very much for your phone call. Dr. Lamantia, sounds like Betsy has a great awareness of things that are affecting her body, and I guess that's something that's really important as we age.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that we need to remember that people, when they go to see the doctor, they spend 99.9% of their lives outside of their doctor's office, and they live with themselves every single day. I think providers across the spectrum have to learn to listen to their patients about what they're hearing going on with their own health every day. What I heard in Betsy's story also is that she's doing one of the things that's really very important for her own health. Proactively, she's staying very physically active. That's really very important. And it sounds like she's also paying a good deal of attention to her diet, eating healthy foods, staying physically active, staying mentally engaged, and then certainly staying socially engaged with the others around you in your community are all very important steps that people can take to proactively, hopefully, ward off illness and the hazards of growing older, and stay well.
I would add also that it really what that story just illustrated for me was that level of self-awareness about yourself, about your body, about your needs, about what works for you. I think that that's also one of the very distinct differences between generations before the boomers and what the boomers are like now. People are very aware of themselves. They're used to knowing what works for them and what doesn't work for them, and they're used to advocating for themselves. And so that is also going to create a really different aging experience for that population and for populations to come. You know, I would imagine that Michael, you could probably name lots of patients that you have that are really self-advocating for themselves when they're sitting with you, because that's a very different paradigm. That's a very different way of being than what you might have seen in older people before that.
Well, I agree with you completely, Monica, on this. We're seeing this shift in our clinics day to day. I welcome it wholeheartedly because I think that an engaged patient is someone who's more likely to follow the prescription that you come up with together for their health. And that prescription doesn't have to mean medicines. That prescription can mean a non-pharmacologic, a non-medication-based approach to keeping yourself healthy.
Some people think that this baby boom generation is approaching retirement a little differently than previous generations. Jenna Clare is the director of the Montpelier Senior Activity Center, and she says her members are asking for more courses to strengthen their physical and mental health.
The biggest population that we're serving is from age 65 to 75. So the boomers really are showing up in great numbers here, and we've seen an increase not only in membership but in demand for programming. So we've had to grow tremendously over these recent years to keep up with that demand. To the point where we're now offering over 70 classes a week.
So, Monica, is this true? Is this baby boom generation kind of redefining what it means to grow old? Is it different? Are they approaching retirement differently than previous generations, do you think?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. I think it's absolutely true. I think when you imagine, you know, I play this game sometimes and I ask people, what do you imagine retirement to be like? And I think when I asked that question several years ago, this idea of kicking back, relaxing, not doing anything, those are the primary answers I would have received. I think now people talk about what they want to do next, what's coming around the corner next. And I think it's also really important to acknowledge that there is a population of individuals who are reaching retirement age who are not necessarily going to be able to retire. You know, we've got grandparents raising grandchildren. We've got adults who are caring for older adults. I think there are many people who can't financially decide to just retire, so they keep going, they keep working. But still, what they expect from their older years is going to be a little bit different in terms of what they need and want, what they're looking for. And I think that has changed completely, and it's important that we change our social programs, our social narrative, the way that we make decisions politically, the policies that get crafted. We have to change all of those to match up with the needs and desires of a very different population.
I agree with you completely, and I would add to that that there are some persons when they hit age 65 and they normally would think about retirement that they don't want to retire. Mm-hmm. They want to stay active and engaged in their community. I always feel like a little bit of a financial advisor when I tell people to think about retirement as a process rather than a date, that this is something that you think about how you're going to still stay engaged, still stay active in your community, still give yourself something that you want to get up every morning and have zest for attacking the day with. That's really important. And I think that I'm seeing people more and more incorporate this into their thinking as they approach this process.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Stephen in West Burke. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon. Timely show. Appreciate it. I had a couple quick comments I wanted to make, and I'll take any responses off the air. The first thing I want to mention is a little earlier in the show, we talked about things that affect you later on in life from what happened when you were younger. And all I want to say is anybody out there hear this, smoking. Every physical ailment I have in my 60s right now is due to what I did in my 40s. And, of course, hindsight's always 20/20. And the other issue is once you find a physician that you're comfortable with, that you're friendly with, then you can be more honest with them. And let's face it, if you're paying somebody for their opinion, pay attention to it. It's silly to pay and then ignore what they have to say. So I've had the same physician for over 25 years. I respect and believe him 100%, and it goes the other way. It lets me be honest with him as well. That is a great thing. And the last thing I want to say is we all heard our grandparents say prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, now I'm the grandparent, and prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's all I got to say, and thanks for a great show.
All right, Stephen, thanks very much. We want to talk about primary care doctors and the importance of having a primary care doctor a little later in the program. Right now, we want to discuss something that's very important, and that's a sense of community for people. Dr. Lamantia, do you think, I know Don George up at Blue Cross said, exercise, eat well, but that sense of community, that sense of connection is just as important as the other two.
Well, I think he couldn't be more right about this. I mean, we're human beings, and humans depend upon social connections with other human beings. And it doesn't do our brain or our body well if we sit within our own homes and just stare at the same four walls every day. We need to be out talking with each other, engaging with each other. That helps our mental health. It helps our cognition and keeps our brain sharp. And then we're more likely when we're engaged with other persons to get out, I believe, and do physical activity rather than just sit on the couch all day. I think it's incredibly important, and being social is a key part to staying healthy as you age.
And let's not forget that our communities need our older Vermonters out
exactly.
and about. We rely on older Vermonters. There are caregivers, there are volunteers, there are foster grandparents, those older Vermonters who haven't retired that are still working. You know, we need to keep our community in balance, and that means really respecting and recognizing place for all and encouraging those older Vermonters to get that social connection and to give back, because that's how our community works in Vermont.
And I know we've talked about this topic before, Martha. Monica, this is very, very important that when we have people who retire, we think about the possibility of losing all of that wisdom from our workforce or from our communities. And we can't afford to do that. People are living longer than ever, and we need that wisdom to be shared with all of us who are still in the workforce, who are still trying to build and make our communities the best places they can be. We need the engagement of our seniors with us. And just because they've turned 65 does not mean that we want them to just sort of close the blinds and not engage with us anymore. Right. We need their engagement.
It's interesting to notice that Vermont is also one of the top states in the country when it comes to the percentage of people over 65 who volunteer at local nonprofits or other organizations. Here's economist Tom Cavett.
There are also people that are giving back a tremendous amount to their communities. So you have a phenomenal pool of highly skilled and experienced volunteers that can enrich communities throughout the state.
Monica, why do you think that's true? When you look at the national list, in Vermont, in some cases, the rate of volunteerism is three times that of other states.
Why do I think it's higher in the state of Vermont? I think that this is very indicative of this Vermont ethic that we all celebrate and enjoy and love so much. You know, this idea of community. Somebody said to me recently, you know, Vermonters are those folks that are not, you know, going to get in your way. They're not going to get in your business. They're not going to bother you. But when something is needed, they come together in a way unlike anybody else in this country. And I moved. I'm a transplant, I admit. And I had a very interesting experience when I first moved here. Didn't know any neighbors, but had a terrible car accident in my family. And people came out of the woodwork to help. I think that that's Vermont. I really do. And I think that that's partly why we see such a high level of volunteerism. People are giving back when they have the time and when they see the need.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Cecilia, who's calling from Windsor. Hi, Cecilia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Well, I appreciate the attempt at positively reframing getting older that your guests are presenting. I want to respectfully disagree or hope to expand that goal. And I think if we just try to sort of flip the idea of growing old to 80 is the new 30 or something, we really haven't overcome ageism. For many people getting older, like myself, vulnerability, weakness, frailty are part of the experience. But that doesn't mean, that doesn't have to mean a lack of creativity, community engagement, and so on. And I'm part of the baby boom generation and find my own ways to contribute, give back, and be creative and have a life that means something to me, although I would also be considered vulnerable, weak, and frail, despite my best efforts. So, and then I also wanted to say something about the need for the community. Given the demographic shift in family, many people are not, staying in marriages their whole lives and don't have extended family around. And so the baby boom generation has been pretty good at making family out of friends. And we're going to see a lot of really interesting and creative approaches to the later years with my group, and some of us will have chronic illness and all the other ills. So that's all I wanted to say.
Cecilia, thank you very much for your phone call.
Cecilia, thank you so much for calling me out. I think that that's, I'd put you on the payroll if I could right this second. That is fabulous. You're right. It's not about making 80 be the new 30. It's making 80 be the new 80. And you're absolutely right in saying that part of the human experience at any age can be vulnerability and can be weakness and can be frailty. And I by no means want to imply that that's not reasonable and fair. And as a community, we need to come together when anybody is in need. And I feel like you are a tremendous example of that. So thank you. I really appreciate that call.
I would just add to those comments that, I think about it as having the two R's. When you come into the doctor's office, I try and bring two R's to the table. I mean, one is relentless positivity. We need to be positive and try and frame things, because if we start talking negative all the time, the likelihood that we're going to be able to incorporate sometimes important preventative steps to address health needs as they develop goes down if we're going to speak in a negative tone. So relentless positivity, I think, is one way that I approach my encounters with patients. The other R, though, is the reality. I try and put myself into the shoes of my patients and accept the reality of the struggles that they're having. I respect the challenges that they face, and then I try and think about what resources we can bring to the table to meet them where they are. So I appreciate the comment, and I don't want to be overly naive that just positive thinking is going to get us there.
Let's talk to Larry, who's calling from Benson. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Yes, I'm 73. I've taken care of my diet, spirituality, my community, social life, physical activity. I am a cancer patient, and I really like the tone of the last call. I want to go just a bit further. Up to this point, the conversation has sounded a lot like a lot of conversations around cancer, that if you die of cancer, well, you've failed in hope and positivity and faith in those areas. This is actually a matter of statistics, and every individual falls in a different path through those statistics. So even doing all the things you're recommending, which are very good to do, there is no guarantee of where you're going to end up. Thank you.
Larry, thank you very much for your phone call. Dr. Lamantia, Larry makes a very important point.
Well, he does. I mean, none of us get out of this alive. That's the fundamental truth about it. But what we're hoping to do is compress what we call in the medical field morbidity. We're trying to compress disease that affects the quality of life for persons into the end of their life, so that more people live disease-free for a longer period of time. One of the terms that's become very popular in my field is to talk not so much about the lifespan, but to talk about the health span. What is the amount of time that you spend with healthy, productive years in front of you? Because that really is what we all want to do. I've never met an older adult who says, I want to be old, I want to be not independent, I want to live in a facility. No, I've heard everyone but one patient in my almost 20 years of walking in and out of hospitals in various roles. Everyone but one has said to me, I want to live independently at home, doing everything that I love doing for as long as possible.
Well, during our series, VPR's Howard Weiss-Tissman reported on a number of housing issues involving the baby boom generation. Maura Collins of the Vermont Housing Finance Agency told him that many boomers want to downsize, but that this development is creating some problems.
Our older population is really competing with millennials for what we would traditionally think of as a starter home. And so having two competing populations for that one unit in a state with a housing crunch is not good news, and we are very concerned about that.
Many people in the baby boom generation also want to stay in their own homes as long as they can. Beth Stern is the director of the Central Vermont Council on Aging.
I think the challenge for baby boomers potentially will be that we're a much more mobile society now, and the children of baby boomers are living elsewhere. You may not have generations and family support that you might have had originally when people tended to stay more local. And so caregiving is going to be a huge issue for baby boomers.
Monica, does Vermont have a support system in place to deal with the increased demand for caregivers that's about to take place?
Well, that's a huge question. Interestingly enough, I think that there is nationally a real challenge in the healthcare industry, in the workforce around caregiving. I think we're seeing a lot of pressure across the country. Certainly Vermont is not unique in that. But Vermont is seeing a lot of that pressure as well. Vermont is actually seeing a real workforce pressure globally, right? I know that people have heard Governor Scott talk a lot about that. And so I think that there are a lot of solutions possible, you know, I think really enticing and bringing people to Vermont, keeping our young people in Vermont, taking advantage of the older population itself, of our population of individuals with disabilities to try to meet that need. All of that is going to be necessary as we look to expand the workforce and make that, make sure that that supply meets the demand that's out there. There are also lots of informal caregivers. You know, the estimates for Vermont are around 65,000 informal caregivers providing care to a family member, to an older Vermonter, to a child that might have need for that care. So there's a lot of that happening as well. There's a lot of supply and demand in the world at large, in society at large. I think the housing is another conversation where you need to make sure that you're matching supply to the demand that's out there and not working hard not to pit any one population against another as we look at what the needs are.
I was just going to jump in there, Monica, and say that as a private citizen and as a concerned Vermonter who sees these issues play out every day, I would really like to see us broaden the conversation out among our society as well as among the members of our legislature and our executive branch of government about what strategies we're going to build in the coming years to deal with the coming crisis around caregiving. I mean, to take just one condition that I know we all know well in the field, if we look at the numbers around dementia in the state, there's going to be a 42% increase in the number of persons with dementia, and there are over 30,000 caregivers for persons with dementia in our state. When you start to look at the economic impact of that, there are over 34 million hours of unpaid care provided to persons with dementia in our state. And the economic value of that is $430 million. And that's accompanied by $23 million in higher health care costs. So these are numbers that when you first look at them, you're tempted to potentially gloss over. But then you look at the magnitude of them and you see that these have real economic consequences to them. And I think are going to demand more attention from our leaders in government across the state.
Let's turn to Julia in Rutland. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I've been watching this issue for a while. I'm in that demographic. And, you know, long story short, I have a lot of things that contribute. But mainly, I want to point out, you know, when you start talking about retirement options, I'm saying what retirement? I'm expecting to live to work as for a living, to earn my living, to pay my bills, as long as I'm upright. And I know a number of people have said the same thing, friends of mine. Now, what we're running up against, though, is the Vermont's announced drive to bring more young people into the state, and they'll even go so far as to mention an age range somewhere between 24 and 45 or whatever the range is that, you know, happens to be in the news. And we look at that from my perspective and we go, yeah, but, you know, we're already here. And when we get into work situations sometimes and land a job, we're working with younger people who sometimes they're impatient because we don't maybe have the technical skills that they learned in school, or we don't think as fast as they do, even though we have the, cultural and historical and experience that they may be lacking. But, you know, there's kind of a disconnect there, and I'm just concerned about the possibility of discrimination, employers aiming for that age group and leaving out, you know, us or housing providers aiming for that age group. I think the answer there is to remind everybody that, you know, there are laws on the books against discrimination based on age. So I'd like to just hear your comments on what I've said. Thank you.
Julia, thanks very much for your phone call. Along those lines, as the baby boom generation becomes a larger part of the state's population, there are going to be some economic impacts and employment impacts, just like you were talking about. UVM economics professor Art Wolf says employers will need to make some adjustments if they want to hire older workers to fill some of their vacancies.
They're going to have to figure out ways to either deal with a smaller number of workers or figure out ways to attract more people into the labor force, that is, you know, senior citizens. They want, you know, if you're trying to get someone who's 67 years old to either continue working or to come back to work, you might have to do different things than if you're trying to attract a 30-year-old into the labor force.
And Monica, what about this idea that Julia mentioned that there, you know, maybe some people don't want to hire older workers?
Yeah, I have so much I want to say about this topic. Julia, thank you so much for that call. I think when I've heard Governor Scott talk about this drive to get younger workers into Vermont, I've also heard him say, and I've been so gratified to hear this, I've heard him say this very thing, that as Vermonters, we don't ignore any of our natural resources. And so even though we want to bring more young people into the state, we want to keep our young people from leaving, we can't ignore our natural resources. And our natural resources are our older Vermonters who are in the workforce, who are choosing to stay in the workforce, who may be coming back to the workforce. Recently, there was the awarding of the Governor's Award for Business Excellence in Supporting Mature Workers. It's the second year in a row that we've done this. We did it inaugurally last year in 2016, and in 2017, we did it again. And four companies across the state of Vermont won awards this year, or certificates of recognition, for policies and practices that support older workers, that support mature workers. And the exciting thing about that is that those same policies and practices support younger people in the workforce, young families with kids to care for, the millennials that are coming into our system and starting work. Those same good policies around flexibility and telework and shifts in hours or public transportation or support for public transportation to and from work, to the kind of accommodations that people would like to have in their workplace. Those same things work for older workers, work for younger workers, you know, work for folks with young families. The issue of discrimination, I think, can be very scary, and I would be naive to pretend that it might not be real. And that is part of why we need to have this conversation and change the entire narrative about aging in Vermont so that people begin to really remember and recognize the value of those older workers who stabilize workforces, who add experience and training, who are mentoring our younger workers. That is critical when you think about the kind of turnover that companies don't want to have and don't want to see. They are the backbone of our workforce. And I think that most really smart companies recognize that, and we need to keep promoting that message and that concept.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Gregory, who is calling from North Stratford, New Hampshire. Hey, Gregory, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My question is basically if you could speak about behavioral health and mental health, particularly in primary care, as it relates to our senior citizens.
Okay. Dr. Lamantia, let's talk about mental health and also the importance of having a primary care doctor. You've referred to that as everybody needing to have a health care quarterback.
Oh, exactly. I think it's very important that there be somebody who's leading the conversation about how to manage your health the best way possible. I think that a critical component of being healthy as you age is making sure that you address any mental health challenges that come up. Depression is incredibly common out there, but it's a treatable illness. It remains treatable even among older adults. Too often, though, when this is the difficult part about developing depression, is that people then lose hope that things could ever be different. And as people face depression when they get older, it sometimes is written off as being something other than depression. No, this is just people will say, no, it just happens with aging. No, this is to be expected. No, grandpa is really just becoming forgetful, when really, no, it's that grandpa's not becoming forgetful. Grandpa's depressed, and he's having problems with his cognition as a result. So depression is something that we, of course, should be screening for when we go for those annual visits with your doctor when you're checking in. And it's important that primary care doctors across the state have means of getting people into treatment. Certainly, they should be looking to treat those cases of mental health that they can treat themselves and feel comfortable with, but they should have adequate resources of other specialists and other resources out in their community that they can reach out to if they feel that things are a little bit more complicated than they're used to.
Let's talk to Louise, who is calling from Bromont, Quebec. Hi, Louise. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and thank you. I'm not really a baby boomer. I'm 73 years old, but I'm close enough. I have some ideas on how to be well as long as possible, and I had a good beginning. My mother was taking fish oils when I was in gestation period. I have never smoked. I stay away from doctors. I have no children because it's a great stressor. It fits me. I have friends who are in their 50s, keeps me young, and I exercise regularly every morning, 30 minutes. I take the day off on Sunday. I maintain all by myself a 2,400-square-foot condo with two stairwells. I run up and down. And I take quercetin and other supplements to sweep away senescent cells in my body. What else? A glass of red wine every day. And I, as I said, I have my younger friends. And I eat 100% organic and 80% raw as much as possible. And when I eat cooked foods, I take enzymes. I study every single day. I'm interested in medical research publications mainly. What else do I want to say? Stay positive as much as possible. Whenever something negative happens, try to turn it over in your mind and find the positive aspect of whatever happens, because life is not easy. And that's about it.
Okay, Louise, it sounds like you've got this figured out pretty well. Thank you very much for your phone call. Monica, we're almost out of time, but for folks who are listening, any last words of advice as baby boomers move their way through retirement?
I think our callers have hit on so many of those points. You know, this so much to me is about choice. You know, what are the choices that are in front of me right now? What are the choices that we want to have available to us as we go forward? I think it's really important that none of us surrender as much as we can, hold on to those choices and those decisions at whatever level we can. That's what's really most important about aging and aging well.
And this week's stories about how the baby boom generation is affecting the state of Vermont is really just the beginning of our coverage of these issues. We hope to focus on many more issues in the future weeks. Many thanks to our guest today, Monica Hutt, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, and Dr. Michael Lamantia, Head of Geriatric Medicine at UVM's Larner College of Medicine. Thank you both very much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Vermont Edition for today. On Monday, as a journalist, I hate to say this, but fake news is real. We'll talk to Dartmouth College Professor of Government Brendan Nyhan about a new study that he and his students have completed on this topic. Send your real comments and questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.